From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, musician and singer Neil Young. His new album, Prairie Wind, is considered the third in a trilogy that includes his 1972 album, Harvest, and his 1992 album, Harvest Moon. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Capote, the new film starring Philip Seymour Hoffman. It's about the six-year period in which Truman Capote wrote his breakthrough book, In Cold Blood. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. When singer-songwriter Neil Young was a young man, singing to and about his dad in the song Old Man, his lyrics included a line referring to his own age and outlook. 24, and there's so much more. Well, Neil Young is about to turn 60, and his new album features songs devoted mainly to looking backward. His father died in June at age 87. Young himself suffered a brain aneurysm in March. But in the days between his diagnosis and surgery, he went into the recording studio and recorded a series of brand new songs. After recovering, he returned to the studio and completed the process, and the new CD called Prairie Wind, which was released last week. The songs appear in the order in which Young recorded them, in the style of his more intimate acoustic albums like Harvest, Comes a Time, and Harvest Moon. They touch on such resonant subjects as family, memory, home, faith, the beauty of wilderness, and the joy of music. This Old Guitar is about the instrument he's playing, once owned by Hank Williams. Prairie Wind, the title song, is about Neil's father and begins by confronting frankly the dementia that dominated his dad's last years. That's the title song from Neil Young's new CD, Prairie Wind. Young performed the entire album in concert last month at Nashville's Ryman Auditorium, the former tabernacle that served for more than 30 years as the home of the Grand Ole Opry. The concert was filmed by Jonathan Demme, who plans to make a movie based around Young and this brand new album. We're going to hear from two of Terry's interviews with Neil Young. She spoke with him first in 1992 when Harvest Moon was released.
You were in high school bands. Did you sing in those bands?
After the beginning, I did. I started as an instrumentalist. We used to do songs, instrumentals that I used to write, you know, melodies and play them on the guitar, sort of like a group called The Shadows from England. And then after the English invasion, you know, and also about the same time as Jimmy Reed became popular, the old blues man, Jimmy Reed, with going to New York and...
Bright Lights, Big City.
Yeah, Beeping and Hyde and all these things. You know, about the same time as the British invasion, all these groups singing harmony and playing guitars and everything. Both of those things happened to me at once, so I really couldn't figure out who it was that made me want to sing, but one of them, you know, or both of them at the same time. Then I started singing, and that was... like a milestone.
what do you mean?
People couldn't believe it, apparently. I don't remember it, but I was so into it, I guess I didn't notice that everybody was going, what is that? You know, as I was starting to sing. Of course, now I'm like, you know, Caruso or something. Got it down.
Were you self-conscious about your voice when you started to sing?
No, not really. I never really, I was just glad to be singing. I mean, we could do a lot more songs if I sang them.
No one else in the band could sing?
Nobody in the band could sing. Not nobody else in the band. Nobody in the band. So we did harmony. And we did everything, you know, but it didn't matter.
Now, you say that you weren't self-conscious about your singing, but there are stories about how, you know, like in your first solo album, you intentionally mixed yourself in the background.
No, I mixed myself right up there where I should be, and then they tried out this new scientific process that they'd invented called the CSG Heiko Cog process, which is this unbelievable thing where you can make a stereo record play back on a mono machine just like it was a mono record. They did something to the sound back then. This is when stereo was just coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, you know, a lot of people had mono sets, and the stereo didn't sound right on the mono set. So they came out with this thing. You run it through this machine that this guy made, this little box or something, and it would make it so you could play it both stereo or mono. But in reality, I was a test case for this with my first album. They did this without letting me know. And they put it out like that, and I got the pressings back, and I went, what happened, you know? Then I read this thing that had been added on the album cover where this, with this engineering note that this had employed this technique. And really, it was the worst thing I ever heard. I mean, they just buried the whole center of the record and put it way down. And this, I think they only used it on my record. They decided it didn't work after that.
So it, it wasn't self-consciousness that was behind
it? No. I can look at the next record. My vocal is right up there.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about being in a tight harmony group like Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young?
How did they feel about it? That's the question. It was no longer a tight harmony group.
Do you like being in a harmony like that? I mean, I love your voice. I consider it a very personal voice. Do you know what I mean? A voice that should be singing on its own more so than just like mixed in a harmony.
Well, you know, I like singing harmony too. I sing good harmony with Crazy Horse.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sense in there that, you know, because there's a couple of different ways to sing harmony, you know, and you can, or blends of all of them. But one of them is just real tight harmony, and the other one is where everybody's singing just more or less just singing loose, but in a harmonic structure with a lot of feeling. That's a different kind of harmony, and that's the kind of harmony that I do with Crazy Horse quite a bit. Sometimes we're real successful at that.
So you came from Canada to Los Angeles, became part of Buffalo Springfield, and I guess it was in 1966 you have a really big hit For What It's Worth. And then, you know, people just like loved Buffalo Springfield. This is like the height or the beginnings of the height of the whole kind of counterculture, which is really thriving, particularly on the West Coast. And so suddenly, like, you're really in the thick of it. I mean, you'd gone from what, a small town in Canada, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a half million people, something like that.
Uh-huh. And now, like, you're really in the thick of it. Did you change a lot? Were you, like, a kind of different person than you were?
Well, you know, I think it affected me. I think it got to be a lot of pressure for a while. But, you know, we got through that after freaking out and quitting the band a couple of times and, you know, throwing my guitar against the chair and doing all kinds of stuff. You know, I went through a normal kind of teenage to adult changeover period there.
When you throw your guitar against the chair, do you, in the days when you did that, were you sure you had money to replace it?
No, that
before
was
you
the
threw
point.
It?
No. No, I think I didn't do that every day, but it's just part, I guess, the pressure of being in the band and trying to make things happen. Yeah, we did a lot of things like that. I mean, we were 20, 21 years old. We were kind of crazy for a while, and then, you know, just like anybody else under a lot of pressure. Bunch of kids, and, you know, it was a pretty fast-moving time.
What's something that you look back on and still find really exciting about that period?
Well, the music was great. And it's too bad it was never recorded correctly, or it would have, you know, the Buffalo Springfield would have been far more of a memory than they are now.
What's missing?
The music is missing. There was, you know, this was about the time when people started making records by overdubbing, and new technology was coming in. We had like 8 tracks, We had ways of doing things that weren't that made it possible to layer records, and so instead of going in the studio and singing live like we were so great live, the people producing us they didn't record us the way they should have. If they had just set us up and let us record live, this band would be band probably would have been together and stayed together a lot longer, because we would have had much more success and had a lot more happiness from listening to our records, and, you know, felt like we were getting something done. But at the beginning, it was kind of hard to break through. We still didn't know how to make records, and we didn't have anybody that knew how to make records helping us make records. And instead, we had people who wanted to be record producers for one reason or another who were there, but they really weren't doing anything. Nobody strong came along and said, listen, you guys go in there and sing, and when I tell you to come out and stop playing and singing, then come on in here and it'll sound great. Nobody ever did that. So I feel that was a failing of the Buffalo Springfield, was all the records. There was only Ahmed Erdogan really had a grip on what should be, what the Springfield records should sound like.
What sounds best to you now from those records?
I don't have a favorite.
Okay. I thought I'd play Mr. Soul. What are your memories of that?
Well, the memories of that are the best take of it and the best mix of it and the best version of it is somewhere in the Atlantic vault.
Right.
And the one that we're listening to here is one that where we got away from it and we kept overdubbing and overdubbed guitar parts and added things over top of the original stuff and lost some of the original stuff. And we took it too far. We didn't have anybody to tell us to go home or tell us that had experience telling us what to do. So we lost a lot of the great stuff that we had on tape in the first place, or that we never got a lot of it on tape at all.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, we'll satisfy ourselves with the actually released version of Mr. Soul.
That's Neil Young's song, Mr. Soul, recorded in 1967 with Buffalo Springfield. His newest album, Prairie Wind, has just been released. Terry spoke with him in 1992. When we come back, we'll hear a more recent conversation with Neil Young. This is Fresh Air. When Neil Young's movie and CD project Greendale was released last year, Terry, fighting a bad cold, spoke with him again. It was a project that didn't really fit in with the 21st century music scene. But Neil told Terry that not fitting in is something he's been comfortable with his whole life.
Even when I was in school, I felt I was always happy to wear clothes that had gone out of style. To me, that whenever they were really out, that's when they were really in for me.
Oh, what'd you wear?
I was wearing white bucks like 10 years after Pat Boone, you know.
Where'd you get them?
I had the little thing that you know, you where you You paint them white with this little spongy thing. And
oh,
everything.
I remember that. Yeah.
I do that, you know, and I take off to school, you know, and wearing my white box and red socks. You know, maybe I was the devil or something. I don't know. But to me, it was like I was a rock and roll guy. I didn't care about, you know, what was happening. I really didn't like the preppy kids at school that much. And, you know, I didn't want to blend in with them. I look around. I see people today. I'm there. I'm still in the classroom. they're still there. You know, my brothers in arms, whoever they are.
Although you have been unpredictable and always moving forward in your music, there have been a couple of real constants in your life over many years. One was Crazy Horse, a fairly constant part of your musical life, and the other is your family. You even tour with your wife and usually with your two sons.
Yeah, my daughter too.
Did you ever expect that so much of your life would revolve around family and around being a father?
Well, I never really
thought about
it. As a
rock and roll guy, you know.
Well, I've broken a lot of the rock and roll rules by being married for 25 years. I guess that's all because I have such a wonderful wife. I mean, we don't have a textbook cleaver family type of marriage, but we have a rock and roll marriage, and it's great. And she's adapted. And the telling thing about our marriage, I think, and the proof of its goodness, is the fact that I've been able to remain creative, and that I've been able to change throughout. Some people, when they get married, they so-called settle down and they fit into something. And some people, when they get into relationships, adapt their personalities to fit the relationship, and then they lose themselves. And, living with Peggy has never put the strain on me to do any of those things. And it's always been a good thing, and she's always, been behind the things that I've done, even if she admitted that she didn't understand what I was doing or didn't know if it was the right thing or whatever. She was still behind the creative part of what I was endeavoring to do.
Now, your two sons both have cerebral palsy. Your older son has a milder case. Your younger son, a severe case that's left him basically a quadriplegic. And he can't talk either. Does he understand speech?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure, yeah, he understands what's going on because, you know, even when you start spelling things that he wants to do, he gets very excited about things. So if I was to mention something that he really wants to do, he anticipates a lot, you know. So if we were to talk about it, so you just drop one word and he's going, jumping out of his chair. So, he does understand what's being said around him. And he also understands, he's learning how to spell because we stopped saying certain things that would get him so jacked up and started spelling them, and he figured that out. So, he's all there in that way, and he's a real good communicator. You just have to get used to how he's communicating and learn how to communicate with him. And he's got a lot of soul, guy.
In listening to you tell part of the story of Greendale, it seemed to me you really enjoy storytelling. Were you able to tell stories to Ben when he was growing up?
Well, I just talk to Ben about everything. So Ben probably knows more about me than anybody. And, because I figured that the best thing I could do is just tell him, mostly almost everything that was on my mind, unless I thought it was something that might scare him or something, So I just... Ben and I spend a lot of time together, and I'm always talking.
I wonder if you think your music has been affected. Does Ben respond a lot to music?
Oh yeah, yeah. He's subtle in his response to it, but my music has definitely been affected by being the father of Ben and Zeke and all the kids. And they're all it's about how hard things are for people with disabilities. When you live with someone with a disability and you realize what they have to go through to do certain things that we take for granted, and then you see somebody in perfectly good health or somebody saying, oh, that's too hard, I can't do that, There's something that snaps in me when that happens. And there's nothing that I can't try to do if I want to do it. I know that how hard it is for my son to do what he wants to do.
Do you think that helped you grow up? And I mean this in the sense that there's a lot of rock stars who, in some ways, seem to have never grown up.
Well, I don't know how much I've grown up. Part of me might have grown up a long way, and another part of me may just be way back there in kindergarten or something. But, my life has been very extreme. So I've learned to accept extreme things and, to take strength from them.
Neil Young speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Sailing hardships through broken harbors, out on the waves in the night. Still a searcher must ride the dark horse, racing along in his fright. Tell me why.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from NPR stations and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of portable professor audio courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Robert's Ridge, a story of courage and sacrifice on Taker Gar Mountain, Afghanistan, by Malcolm McPherson, and from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, getting his first guitar, we continue our conversation with Neil Young. His new album is Prairie Wind. Also, David Edelstein reviews Capote, the new film about Truman Capote and the writing of his breakthrough book, In Cold Blood. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to our conversation with Neil Young. His new album, Prairie Wind, has just been released. It was recorded last spring, right after Young learned that he had a brain aneurysm that would require surgery. In the few days between the diagnosis and the operation, Young flew to Nashville and recorded 8 of the 10 songs on the album. Prairie Wind also includes a DVD which documents the recording session. Here's another song from that album.
Summer days come tumbling down, and you find yourself alone. Then you can come back and be with me.
Here for You, from Neil Young's new CD, Prairie Wind. Let's get back to his interview with Terry. It was recorded last year when Terry was fighting a cold.
No, I read someplace, and I don't know whether this is true or not, that you had polio when you were a child.
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah, I did. I was six.
How did it affect you? I mean, what? Physically?
Well, you know, I had to learn how to walk again at six.
Uh-huh.
And that's basically all it was, you know. Part of my body is not quite as sensitive as the rest of it, my left side. But it's no big deal. I just learned how to deal with it.
Were you listening to music yet when you were that young? Because I know sometimes when kids are sick, they just, like, they read a lot or they listen to music, and it really changes them.
I can't remember when I wasn't listening to music.
What were you listening to when you were young?
Well, the first thing I remember was, you know that song, The Three Bells, a French song about, you know, the Three Bells, it's called? The Browns did a version of it about 40 years ago. Well, the original version was a French version, and God, it was so beautiful, and we had it on a 78. I used to listen to it over and over and over again. And we had a version of Greensleeves that I used to listen to all the time.
Can you sing a couple of bars of the bells so listeners will know the song you're talking about?
You know the one, in the little congregation, you know, prayed for guidance from above. And remember that song?
I do. It was
Jimmy
like a
Brown, the story of Jimmy Brown,
yeah,
or whatever
it was.
It was
like a hit in the early 60s or something.
Yeah, and that was the English version. The French version, the first one, was just sensationally great and really beautiful. But the English one was good, too. But the one I heard was the French one. So I don't know. I can't even remember how I understood what it was, but it didn't seem to matter.
Did your parents buy you a lot of kids' records?
Did my parents buy me a lot of kids' records?
Yeah.
No, I bought my own records. I went out, you know, I used to have a couple of businesses when I was a kid. Chicken business. I raised chickens and sold eggs and everything. And I also would, you know, go find golf balls at the golf course and sell those to the golfers. Quite often the same ball a guy hit, I'd sell to him.
What a racket.
That's where I got my sales expertise. And so after that, you know, I have a little bit of money, and I go down and buy the latest 45 RPMs or whatever. And, you know, I think I bought a lot of records when I was a kid. And I used to listen to WLS out of Chicago. Even though I was way up in Winnipeg, I could still pick it up. And I used to listen to, you know, the Dick Biondi and little Alan Freed when I could get that, the old rock and roll.
So this is great. So you raised chickens and sold eggs and resold golf balls so that you could buy 45s.
Yeah, more or less, that's it, yeah.
What were the very first records you remember buying?
Well, the first records one of the earliest ones, I think, was old Jerry Lee Lewis records and Little Richard and those records. And then about the late 50s and early 50s, I bought, you know, records by the Monotones and Buddy Holly and Ronnie Self and the Chantels, all these great records, you know, R&B type records. And then Jimmy Reed. I bought all Jimmy Reed's albums when I was in grade 8 or 9 or something in high school. And I had all his early records. And, you know, I really like R&B.
And when did you get your first guitar?
Well, my dad bought me a ukulele. I guess I was around 8.
Why did he get you a ukulele as opposed to a guitar?
It's small.
Oh,
small enough
sure.
for me.
Sure.
It's just a little plastic Arthur Godfrey one. Then he played it for me, and he sang all these sad songs, you know, Bury Me Out on the Prairie and all these ridiculous cowboy songs that he knew from God knows where. And then he'd smile and he'd play it along. And then after that, my uncle came by, and he was really good on the ukulele, and he played the thing and played all these chords, and then it turned out he could play anything. He played piano, guitar, ukulele, horns, and then He even played his three daughters. He had them singing. He had them in three-part harmony singing background for him while he was singing, and he taught them all these things. It was amazing. Mm. So my cousins all sang, and you know, harmony.
So when did you switch from ukulele to guitar?
Well, I got... after a ukulele, I got a thing called a banjo ukulele, which is plays like a ukulele but looked like a banjo. I think it cost about $15. I got it for Christmas one year. Then I got a baritone ukulele, which is like a ukulele but it's bigger, kind of like a really small guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And then I advanced up to the guitar because the first four strings on a guitar are the same notes as a ukulele, basically. So,
did you get lessons on any of this?
I had two guitar lessons in 1962.
Well, it took you a long way, I guess.
it took me a long time to get to the place where I had to take them, and I hated those lessons. I never could understand what they were trying to show me.
What'd you hate about it?
I don't think I learned anything there.
What'd you hate about the lessons?
I don't know. I didn't remember. I tried to block it all out of my head. I don't even remember what they were trying to show me. It's one of those things I didn't enjoy that... Luckily, my mind works such that now I don't remember any of it. Right? I only remember walking in the door.
Are there any things that you taught yourself that are officially wrong?
Yeah. Yeah, sure, all kinds of things. Officially wrong for guitar playing, you mean?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, playing out of tune is pretty wrong. I do that regularly. And I will continue playing out of tune if I... think it has some kind of a sound, and you know, usually my sound mixer Tim Mulligan has been working with me for about 30 years. He comes up to me and says, "Now listen, your guitar sounds a lot bigger." He just told me this yesterday. He said, "Your sound is a lot bigger when you're in tune. So why don't you just take a minute and tune up in between songs?" So the other night I actually stopped and I gave my guitar to Larry, my guitar tech, and he tuned it right in the middle of it. You know, I'm not that good at tuning. I got these strobe tuners, and I use them, but it's distracting. Tuning is distracting. And then when I have to take my guitar off and have somebody else tune it, I feel like I'm naked up there. I don't know what the hell to do with myself, standing there in front of all these people screaming and yelling because we just tore the house down doing something, and then I don't have my guitar. I'm waiting for it to be tuned, you know. It's a very kind of a vulnerable moment there when I don't have the guitar. So I'd rather than tune or do anything, I just want to keep playing because I know how to play, and, you know. So that's, I get in trouble there. That's majorly wrong to play out of tune, and I do that a lot.
That's great. So you play out of tune because you can't give up your armor.
That's right. I try to keep it in tune, and, you know, I have a lot of ways of hiding being out of tune.
Your guitar playing just keeps evolving, and I mean, there's so many different voices and styles that you can use to such kind of dramatic and emotional effect. I'm wondering, do you think that comes in part from always listening to new things, or is that not related? Is what you're playing not related to what's coming in as input?
You know, guitar playing I guess a metaphor for guitar playing would be deep earth mining or something. And you just keep banging away and blowing through and trying to get to the core. Just keep on going and melting through layers and just keep pushing and try to keep an air hose going so you can get back and so you can get a breath. But you got to get as deep as you can and go down and keep digging. And that's what guitar playing is like for me. Every solo, I'm looking for a way to go deeper. I'm looking for how am I going to lose myself? How can I get to a point where nothing matters? How can I stop thinking? How can I lose track of what's going on and still be in sync? Those are the goals of guitar playing.
Now, do you want to stop thinking in a kind of meditative sense that it feels good and it's a kind of good state to be in to stop thinking? Or do you want to stop thinking because thinking interferes with playing?
Thinking is in the way, and no, it's just in the way. It's all about feeling, and that there is some kind of an ability to play that happens because your mind is doing something. It's saying, okay, now you can do this, now you can do that. But that's more like tools that I have when I'm boring into something.
Neil Young speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with Neil Young. His newest album, Prairie Wind, has just been released.
When you were younger, were you obsessive about technique? And did you get enough kind of technique through obsession that enabled you to, like, stop thinking and go for emotion?
The first time, you know, I remember maybe I was 17 or something, and I was playing, and you know, I worked on things. I learned songs. I wrote a lot of instrumentals myself, and I'd practice them and get to play them and everything, but they didn't have a lot of improvisation in them. And, you know, and they had melodies, and I liked the melodies, and then I started singing, and I liked the way it felt when I sang a certain melody and got a certain sound. But really, God, guitar playing and thinking is so deep. I just, the guitar playing itself is, you know, when I was young, I think I was about 17. I was playing this little club, and I had my band, and we were doing a cover song. We played a song by the Premiers called Farmer John, and there were some other musicians around, and one of them was a really, really good guitar player, and he really could just bend the strings on his Telecaster, and he really just made the thing sing. I thought he was, like, fantastic. He had to be, like, 21 or something. I was, like, 17. And I did something on my guitar where we started playing this song, and then we got into the instrumental, and I just basically went nuts. And I think it was the first time that ever happened. And I just kept playing, and I just kept going and going and grinding and just pounding away at this rhythmic thing and exploring little nuances of it. And I think I don't know how many minutes it went on and on. And then when I came off stage, the guy walked up to me and he says, where the hell did you learn how to do that? He said, what are you doing? And I said, what do you mean, what am I doing? And it's the same thing I've been doing. And he said, oh, no, no. He said, no, I don't know what you're doing. You know, and he knew like 200,000 more chords than I did and all the scales and everything. And he just said, I just don't know what you're doing. He said, what did you do? And at that point, you know, I realized, well, there's a place I can go, and I just kind of fell into it by accident, and I think I spent the rest of my life trying to get there.
Now, can you compare that to singing? Is there a place vocally for you like that?
Yeah, but I'm not a very good singer, and you know, like, I don't have real good pitch control, and especially have trouble singing freely, like. I can sing a melody and I can sing words and I can put them together with chords and get a feeling going. But the way Otis Redding sang, you know, that soulful, free-flowing expression, I have trouble with that. I have trouble opening up enough to really open up my soul and let things go. I really, you know, and when I try to do it, every once in a while I get there and it kind of feels like that first guitar solo felt to me. But, you know, when I try to go back, it's like, oh, you're just trying to do the same thing over again that you did before. It's not like I'm entering a new domain. It's like I'm copying something. So I still haven't figured out how to get to that space.
But I love your singing.
Well, thank you. I'm trying.
You know, I'm listening to your speaking voice and thinking about your singing voice, and that, you know, you have a pretty big range singing, and you sing lower and you sing higher up, but your higher up voice is, you know, considerably higher, I think, than most of your speaking voice.
Well, I've been on the road here for the better part of a year, so, and I just finished a show last night, and, you know, about 150 miles away from here.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a show the night before that, about 300 miles away from that, and I've driven to those places and driven back to the city, and you know, so my voice is a lot lower right now than it naturally would be if I wasn't on the road.
Some of the images that you've used today are so good, like your image about guitar playing and about going deeper down. It was just a really nice image, and I was wondering, I know your father was a writer, a sports writer. And do you think you were influenced at all, language-wise, being the son of a writer?
Well, I think there's always that influence.
Of course, there's your lyrics, too. I'm just thinking about hearing you talk. But, I mean, you've written
you know, throughout, written lyrics throughout your whole career.
Well, you know, my dad wrote a lot of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And he
fiction?
Yeah, fiction and nonfiction. But he did write a lot of fiction. And he used to try to write a little bit every day. And I'm not like that. I only try to write when I feel like writing. But if I feel like writing, I don't care what else is going on. I won't do it. I will write. And I think that's why I've written so many songs. If an idea comes to me out of nowhere, I look at it like a gift. It's not a distraction. Everything else in the room is a distraction. I don't care what it is. So in that way, I'm committed to the muse. I roll with the muse. Wherever it goes, if it comes to me, I'm going with it. That's what got me where I am today, and that's what made it so that I could create all these things and so that I could put all these people to work that I have, and I have an effect on a lot of people, and just all the things I've been able to do are all because of being faithful to that one thing and realizing that all of this is all coming from somewhere else, and you just have to be there and ready with open arms to take it in and then send it back out in a form that people can understand or that people can enjoy.
Neil Young, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Neil Young speaking with Terry Gross last year. His new acoustic CD, Prairie Wind, has just been released. Prairie Wind also includes a DVD documenting the recording session. Here's another song from that CD. That's Far From Home from the new Neil Young CD, Prairie Wind. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Capote, the new film biography of the writer Truman Capote. This is Fresh Air. In 1959, four members of a Kansas family were murdered in their home, and the capture, conviction, and execution of their killers became the basis of Truman Capote's 1965 bestseller, In Cold Blood. Capote died in 1984 at the age of 59, never having completed another major work. Film critic David Edelstein says the new film suggests why.
Capote tells the story behind the story of the writing of In Cold Blood through the prism of Janet Malcolm's The Journalist and the Murderer, that brilliant book-length essay on the journalist's inevitable betrayal of his or her subject, begins with the provocative and, I think, madly overheated assertion that, quote, every journalist who is not too stupid or too full of himself to notice what is going on knows what he does is morally indefensible. As directed by Bennett Miller and written by Dan Futterman, who cites Malcolm in interviews, the grim story of Truman Capote and his seminal nonfiction masterpiece becomes a tale of duplicity and self-loathing, of the loss of a writer's soul, and the beginning of the end of his artistry. The title character, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, is the droll dandy that many of us remember from Capote's TV appearances in the 60s and 70s. He's the oddball, homosexual southerner with a voice that suggests at once suckling and conniving, the voice of a baby mad scientist. A master manipulator, he speaks so slowly that people have to stop and hang on every self-consciously dazzling word. He has a cult in the boho salons of Manhattan and Brooklyn, but how will his act play in Kansas? That's where Capote heads in 1959, along with his doting friend, the novelist Harper Lee, played by Catherine Keener, when he reads of the inexplicable slaughter of an entire family, the Clutters, in their remote farmhouse. Capote cuts a bizarre figure in the American heartland, but he uses his celebrity and the power of his magazine, The New Yorker, to open both official doors and jail cells. It's in the latter that he develops a tender intimacy with one of the Clutter's killers, Perry Smith, played by Clifton Collins Jr.
We're going to be able to use your book for our case. You're right, we never got to raise an insanity plea. You wrote how terrible the lawyers was.
I haven't written a word yet.
What have you been doing?
Research. Talking to you.
All right.
I had hoped...
What are you calling it?
The book? I have no idea. Perry. If I'm going to write about you, if I'm going to determine how to write about you, we need to talk about, you know, why you're here. You know, the murders that night at the Clutter House.
Of course, Capote has started writing and has got his title. He just doesn't plan to finish In Cold Blood until Smith and his cohort, Richard Hickok, have been hung. That must be the book's big finale. And while Capote cares for Smith, maybe even adores him, he becomes desperate to see him executed so he can finish. Over the years it takes for the killers to exhaust their appeals, Capote's inner conflict between his empathy and opportunism eats him alive. The movie is slow, and gets slower as it crawls to the big scene of Capote extracting from Smith the story of the murders, presented here as a triumphant piece of vampirism. It's powerful and eerie, but I think something's missing. Capote in his work transcended that vampirism, and In Cold Blood fostered more understanding of why people kill than any book I know. I don't know how Futterman and Bennett could have conveyed the depth and humanity of Capote's writing on screen, but a film that ignores this alchemy of creation, that presents the book only in the context of Capote's celebrity and Janet Malcolm-esque exploitation, isn't telling the full story. The distorted mirror image that Capote told friends he saw in Smith is more talked about than dramatized, but the actors fill in much. As Smith, Collins finds the perfect mixture of neediness and cunning. And Hoffman, talk about alchemy. He's much bigger than Capote, but framed to look short. The first few minutes, you're aware of the nightclub impersonation aspect. But Hoffman reportedly listened to many tapes of Capote, and sometimes when gifted and porous actors faithfully duplicate the stammers and pauses of their subjects, the spirit enters into them. Hoffman lays bare this whiny, wheedling, self-absorbed little man who nonetheless could see more deeply than almost anyone alive. If only the movie did more than hint at the genius behind what he saw.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And from Scholastic, presenting the children's book Inkspell by Cornelia Funke at scholastic.com/Cornelia Funke. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, David Cronenberg. The director of The Dead Zone, The Fly, Dead Ringers, and Crash has a new film, A History of Violence, a psychological thriller about one man's potential for violence. Join us for the next Fresh Air.